production here. This is Barry Tyker. Today is January 21st in the year 2000. I'm working for the UW-Madison Archives, and I am going to be interviewing Professor Foster, Professor Ian Foster. This is our third session. Professor Foster, you dug up something between our last interview session and today about a rather interesting episode that occurred at the Food Research Institute. Do you want to talk about that, please?
Well, it was back in 1977, and suddenly the local newspaper, the Capital Times, came out with an expose which included on the front page pictures of the Food Research Institute's coal rooms and some of the other facilities, and the implication that here was an enormous health hazard, the claim actually that here was an enormous health hazard on the campus because the Food Research Institute had stores of Clostridium botulinum toxin, which is probably one of the most poisonous substances known to man, and here it was it was being worked with in a building that housed the former food service facility of the Lakeshore dormitories. And so the implication was that this was an enormous hazard to the campus and to the city and to everybody else. And they got a lot of publicity. I don't know where you want to go from there.
Well, first of all, for the record, the copies of the articles from the Cap Times will be found in Professor Foster's file at the Oral History Project.
All right.
As a result of this, were any changes made in security, anything like that, at the Food Research Institute?
Well, there were some changes made because, we were in that building in the first place because the residence halls department had decided to quit serving food there to students, and it became available. And we needed space for laboratories and to do our work. Mm-hmm. And so we were given the main floor and the second floor. In other words, all the building except the basement. The residence halls people reserved the basement for storage of their material. And after this publicity, they got out of the basement, and we got that too. So we benefited considerably.
Was it a genuine threat?
Oh, heavens, no.
So it was...
No, there was no threat at all. I don't know what stimulated the Capital Times to pull this expose, but it was the best thing that ever happened to the Institute. It gave us another floor of space, is what it amounted to, and it didn't change a thing. We weren't endangering the community or anybody. We were working in a normal fashion as we had been for years and continued to.
So as a result of this really spurious story, you guys actually got a...
We got another floor of the building.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Now, before we got in there, though, we had to... When the residence halls people first vacated the building, made it available, and Dean Pound arranged that we could get it, mm-hmm. It was set up with dining halls and kitchens and things of that sort in the main building. Mm. And so we had to remodel it and make laboratories and offices. And so we had to go out and hustle up about $300,000, as I recall, some substantial amount of money to accomplish this remodeling. But we did that with the help of outside sources, and every way we could get it, we got enough money to remodel the building and made a very satisfactory facility. And that's where we were working. We were doing perfectly normal research. But the Capital Times thought they could get some publicity, and they did.
Yeah, they did, and you did.
We got another floor of the building, and the residence halls, I don't know what they used for storage after that, but that was their problem.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm sure they made some other arrangements.
I'm sure they did.
But that was the basis of this story. Of course, it caused a lot of flap at the time, and I made pictures of it and copies of it. So
great.
You can have
great. That's wonderful. We'll put that in the record. Now, there was also something that we just touched on yesterday that you wanted to talk a little bit about, and that's CLA.
Yeah. Well, back in those days, and this is, I think, in the 70s probably we were talking about, there was a lot of publicity about unsafe food. Mm-hmm. People... Charltons and others were out there claiming that this was unsafe and that was unsafe. And there was a professor of biochemistry named Barry Commoner at the University of St. Louis, I believe. At least he was in St. Louis, and I think that's the school. And he got on the television and claimed that hamburger would cause cancer. And he based this on the fact that extracts of hamburger can cause mutations in bacteria. In other words, an extract of hamburger patty or meat would cause bacteria to mutate. And so he said, well, that means that if you eat hamburger, you can get mutation from it. And cancer can result from the mutation. Something to that effect. It was pretty far-fetched, it seemed to me. And so we had this young professor on the faculty, and he wasn't looking for something to do, but this was something he could do. And so I asked him to investigate this, to really look at it. And so he did. He extracted hamburger, fed it to animals, and lo and behold, it made them grow better.
The opposite of what the Barry Commoner, exactly diametrically.
Exactly. That so often happens. Yeah. So he purified the material that was identified. And it was identified as conjugated linoleic acid. Linoleic acid is a perfectly normal fatty acid, a nutrient. And so he fed this to animals, and he found it made them grow better and things of that sort. And I don't know what all the effects were, but it was good. Mm-hmm. And so this product is now on the market as conjugated linoleic acid, or CLA is the label on it. And people take it for all sorts of things, and it's over the counter. It's not even require. It doesn't even require a prescription. Mm-hmm. So that was a good result of some investigating some of these furious claims that were being made in those days about safety or unsafety of food.
And also, it tells me something about how the Food Institute operates, because you said you had just noticed this article by Commoner and you thought it was an issue on food safety that That's needed right. to be pursued.
That's right.
This wasn't uncommon, was it?
In terms of how we had all kinds of, we had an entire program going, and that's where much of our grant program was aimed at, trying to get at the truth of some of these high-powered claims in the public press by so-called experts or people who thought they were or said they were.
So kind of truth in advertising
type
stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So we had money available to us to support work on the safety of foods, and so we would find somebody in the university who was able and interested, and this went all over. It wasn't just in the institute itself. We went out to biochemistry, we went out to medicine, and we had grants all over the place. 15 or 20 grants at one time, maybe not that many, 10 anyway, good number, and we financed them. The investigator, he investigated them as he saw fit. We didn't tell him how to do it. Mm-hmm. We provided the money and the impetus. He published the results, and that's all there was to it. We were just trying to get out the door. We didn't have the staff in-house in the institute itself, but we had the money that we could use to get to Hector DeLuca or whoever else.
So you're sort of like intermediaries in
a
sense.
We were a granting agency. That's what it
meant. Granting agency on the campus. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And you would handle, like if you gave Hector DeLuca a $50,000 grant or whatever, would you then administer the monies part of it?
I would see that he got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It was just like any other grant that he would get. It would come in through the graduate school, and I don't remember the mechanics of it, but it was handled just like any other grant that he would have. It would come into his department, and the money would be available to him to hire assistants and do whatever he had to do. And then he would publish the results, give us reports.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And so then you would pass these on to the granting agency.
We were the granting agency.
I mean the funding agency.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Wherever we got. Well, much of this money came from food industry. Mm-hmm. It came into us to support the institute. Mm-hmm. We used it then to support the research.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we didn't have in-house, in the administrative unit called the Food Research Institute, we didn't have all the capabilities we needed to go into some of these studies. But we could find other people on campus who did have and so we would give them the grant to do the research. We were just sort of the administrator of the grant program.
And this would also, in some instances, benefit the university in other ways, too. I think last time we'd mentioned CLA in the context of patents. And Wharf patented this, I think it was in the late 90s, and probably is still making money off of it.
Oh, I assume so. I don't know about it,
yeah.
But I would assume so.
Yeah.
But whether it's a money producer or not, that's pretty unusual.
Mm. Okay.
Most of these were just simply straightforward
problem.
Try to get the answer to the problem and publish it and make it available to the public. And that's what we did over and over and over again. We worked on the safety of nitrite. This was the safety of hamburger meat. This was this. We had projects on the safety of colors, food colors, of phosphate. These were all food components that were being accused of causing everything from birth defects to I don't know what.
Yeah.
And so we would find or try to find somebody who was interested and able. We'd give them the money and we would agree upon, of course, what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't use the money to go to Cubs baseball games. they had to spend it just like they would any other university money, because it was university money. Once it came to us, it became university money. So that's the way it worked, and it worked like a charm. We made a lot of, I think we did some good. We got at the truth. That's all we were there for.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of slings and arrows that we had to survive, like this thing. But that's okay.
Did it ever occur when a food industry would give you money to study a problem and you ended up finding things that were really not in that industry's favor, best interest?
I don't remember, but it wouldn't have made any difference if we had. We would publish the results, period. No, they didn't hire us to find their point of view.
They just wanted an honest answer to the issue.
That's right. That was the least of our problems.
Mm-hmm.
We never once, I can't ever remember anyone of even hinting, we'd like for you to investigate this, and we want to be sure, though, you get the right answer. Oh, no. We wouldn't talk to them.
Yeah.
No, that was no problem.
Great. Is it reasonable to say that because of all the activism of the times and printing of books like Silent Spring and the different activists going for different causes, that this in sort of an odd way ended up helping the Institute by raising a lot of questions that would not have might not have been there otherwise?
There's no question about it. Of course it did. I would assume that if it hadn't been for them, we would have still been slogging away at salmonella and botulism and the standard old bacterial problems that interest the scientists but don't interest anybody else much. But these activists were raising all kinds of spurious claims about the food supply being unsafe. And naturally, there were people who didn't like that, and they would like to get at what the facts are.
Mm-hmm.
And we were available and willing to try to get at the truth. And so this helped us a great deal in raising money to get at the truth. Without that, we would have been tough.
Yeah. And then the reputation of the University of Wisconsin behind you was sort of like a seal of approval, essentially.
Of course it was. Course it was. You see, we didn't have any access to grind. We were all on the state payroll, and we were doing our job. We were teaching, and we were training students and everything. And of course, these investigations that were undertaken with our sponsorship and money, they trained students too, in biochemistry and in medicine and in various other places. So it was a useful exercise in all. But the main thing was it got the truth out to the public.
Yeah.
We published the results, or the investigators did, and it became known, and it helped everybody. It helped the country, it helped the industry, it helped us, and it helped
the university and the graduate students.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Everybody.
A win-win-win.
Yeah, it was a win-win situation. Now, I was a little dicey sometimes, but that was immaterial. Yeah. You had to expect that.
Yeah. Well, that comes with the territory, certainly. Like, he's holding up the, Professor Bosler's holding up the picture of the cold room, the plague that never was.
Yeah. Well,
okay.
Does that...
That answers my question. That answers it certainly does. We're going to turn now to some of the awards and honors that you've accumulated in your very distinguished career. You just took me to your apartment and showed me a number of the plaques that you were awarded for distinguished service and from various institutes and whatnot. Now, one that you were awarded early on, and I kind of caught my eye, is a Distinguished Alumni Award from North Texas State College. That was in 1967. Had you kept contact with North Texas State over the years after graduating?
Not very much. I left there in, I guess it was in 1937, and got on a bus, as I told you, and rode to Madison, Wisconsin.
Yes, that's a great, great,
and,
great
anecdote. Spent 3 years at graduate school, and since that time, I don't think I've even visited the campus. I haven't had occasion to. Maybe I drove past it. Yes, I did once or twice, but years ago, like 20, 30 years ago. And but I'm on the alumni list, of course, and they're always expecting a little retribution. And so I see that how it's grown. It's just been enormously developed. See, this is only 30 miles out of Dallas, Fort Worth.
Right, right.
North of there.
Rural back in those days, but probably almost suburban today.
Well, it is almost suburban.
Yeah.
And I guess one of my nephews went to school there, and so... I still see the, I keep up with them as best I can. It's quite a school now, and they've gotten bigger in athletics, they got bigger in everything.
Not really.
Yeah. But they, I doubt, well, there's no way I would know, but they certainly didn't, they had the most inspirational teachers in those days and when I was there. Of course, that's when I was impressionable. And, and
oh, that's where you had your mentor.
That's where
right?
I did my bachelor's and master's degree. That's where I met my wife. And, and she was a student of mine, came in my class. I was a lab assistant. At that time, in biology, the professor taught the labs, but when he had an overflow, well, he'd have to lean on an assistant. And so I usually got the overflow labs.
You got the overflow. Great experience for you.
Yeah, it was. It was indeed. Yeah, so North Texas has, I have a fondness for it, but I'm not yet ready to make a big donation, financial donation.
Another award, you were awarded the Nicholas
Appert
Award in 1969. Who is Nicholas Appert and what does the award recognize? Do you know?
Well, Nicholas Appert was a Frenchman. He invented canning.
Oh, really?
Yes, so. He's the guy that, that invented appetizing, they called it at first. But it's the canning industry is based upon his original work. And what he did was he put food in cans and sealed them up, and then he heated them enough to make them keep, sterilize them, in other words. And so Nicholas Appert was the originator of the process which we now call canning. And he was a Frenchman.
And the award was, what did the award recognize?
I don't know, I guess I'm being a good fellow, well known, and I don't know for any specific thing I did that got it.
There were two
they get one every year.
There were two other people who I whose names I recognized on the list, and one was Conrad Elvium, and the other was Gail Dack, your old colleague and longtime friend, I assume. From
another one is Emil Mrak of... UC Davis, but you wouldn't know him.
No.
Mrak was very big in the food Institute of Food Technologies. And, see, this was done through the IFT.
Oh, okay.
And so somewhere I've got a list of the Appert Award winners, and all these guys are on it that you mentioned. But it's managed by the award is managed by the Institute of Food Technologies, of which I was a member for many years, and I got it one year.
Yeah. Did you have to, was there an award ceremony?
Yeah, at the annual meeting of the thing. You got metal hung around your neck or something, rather.
Huh. Well, that's kind of nice.
I've forgotten now exactly what
I've never had a medal hung around my neck.
Well, we had one. And they just had a meeting in Chicago not long ago, and I almost went, but I didn't. I'm not up to going to those things much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have known anybody.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But it was an honor. I certainly don't denigrate it.
Mm.
Only one a year.
That's right. And there is a list of the winners in Professor Foster's file, if anyone would like to, or the people awarded, awardees, I guess you'd say. Another very distinguished award you got was presented only a few years ago, 1996, the Distinguished Service Award by the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Is that sort of a, how, what is that for exactly, and how is that determined?
I'm not the one to ask that. I don't know.
Yeah.
I know they get one every year.
It's more or less a distinguished service within the college,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
And again, you can find a list of the people who have been selected. And
since it's most recent.
Oh, there it is. It's right behind me. I didn't see it.
I can hand it to you. There's the ceremony.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the program.
Yeah.
And
Distinguished Service Award. You are the one winner of the award.
Yeah.
One a year. That's a beauty.
Another one hung around your neck.
My God. I'm in the wrong business
here. Yeah, you need a lot more hung around your neck.
I need more things hung around my neck. All I get is albatrosses.
Yeah. Well, anyway, of course, I'm very grateful for these things. They recognize, I guess, that I kept my nose clean and I worked hard.
Yeah.
I tried as best I could.
Well, that's a very distinguished award. I mean, we have a very distinguished college here in Cal's.
They
don't give 20 of those a year. They
No.
give one a year. This is
that's right.
This is something you ought to be very proud of.
I am very proud of it. And that's the one I
That would be the one you'd be most.
I think so.
Yeah. I can understand that. There were several other awards that Professor Foster has been awarded throughout his career, and they are on page 2 of his CV, which again is on file in the Oral History Project for anyone interested. You were associated with numerous professional and scientific societies throughout the course of your career. I'd like to just talk a little bit about a couple of these now and get your response to them. You were a member, as a matter of fact, you were president and I believe a charter member of the American Society for Microbiology.
I wasn't a charter member, no.
Oh, okay.
I was a lot.
I've got that wrong.
You were older than I am.
It's older than you are?
Yeah.
Got the wrong one, sorry.
American Academy of Microbiology, maybe.
That's, okay. Check.
Yeah,
the wrong one. That's what I had next on my list. Eyes just jumped down there.
Well, the American Society for Microbiology is an interesting story. I think if you've got time.
We got plenty of tape. Go ahead.
I don't remember when it started, but it was very early in long before I was ever born, I think, and certainly before I was active.
Mm-hmm.
When I came here as a graduate student, I joined as a student member,
mm-hmm.
as I recall. And at that time, the University of Wisconsin's bacteriology department was one of the strongest, groups in the society. It was the Society of American Bacteriologists,
mm-hmm.
they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Baldwin was secretary treasurer. Fred had been president.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Baldwin became president later.
Makes sense.
Hastings had been president. It was just Wisconsin was very strong in this thing. And so when I came along and got my PhD and joined the society, of course, it had about 5,000 members, and the officer who really ran it was the secretary treasurer.
Mm-hmm.
He was a volunteer, somebody they picked out of, I guess, from the back room operations. They think, well, who will we stick with this job next? Who will do it for nothing?
The dubious distinction award.
Yeah, and that's the job that Baldwin had at one time. And, of course, he was later president, too. But at the time I joined the society and got active in it, the secretary treasurer was a man named John Hayes Bailey, and he worked for a company in New York State. It wasn't in New York City. John Hayes Bailey. And so he got to the point where he couldn't handle all the work. Mm-hmm. Now, they had about 5,000 members by that time. And they were buying office services from their publisher. The publisher, who was in Baltimore, named Williams and Wilkins Company. Mm-hmm. And they published the journals that the society, and I'm talking 1945-ish, mm-hmm. and 46 and 48, somewhere in there. Well, Bailey, I guess, decided that he couldn't handle all the work, and so they hired some help from the publisher to send out dues notices and that kind of routine stuff. So they were buying this service. Well, Bailey still couldn't handle all the work, he said. By that time, as I say, they had 5,000 members or so. And so they persuaded me to, I wouldn't say run, to become secretary. But Bailey preferred to keep the treasurer's job, so they split it. Bailey said, I can do the treasurer's work while I'm shaving in the morning. Mm-hmm. And he probably could. Mm-hmm. They had some little extra money they were investing and that sort of thing. Well, that didn't bother me a bit. I wasn't the least bit interested in handling the money. So I became the secretary, in the 50s, somewhere in there. I don't remember what year. We can look it up. And we were operating just fine. Except that this thing was growing and it was getting to be a lot of work, and I soon realized that this isn't the way to run a railroad. Mm-hmm. If you're going to develop this operation, we had three good journals, 5,000 members plus, and really the leading society in the world, as far as I'm concerned, in microbiology. I said, we've got to get our own office. So I convinced the council that we should spend a little money, and we hired a young man over in Detroit. And I remember going over there one weekend, and we rented a couple of rooms over a pizza parlor, and that was the office, became the office. So instead of running it out of my office here, he would handle the mailing list, he'd do all the things that we were buying from Williams and Wilkins and others. Well, just to jump now, we started with that about, I can't remember the year, but it was in the early 60s, as I recall. They now own a $10 million building in downtown Washington. The society does. My. They've got a staff you wouldn't believe. They've got people I don't even know. Oh, lots of people. I don't know any of them, as a matter of fact. This fellow that we hired in Detroit later moved the office to Bethesda or someplace in the Washington mm-hmm. suburbs, and that became inadequate. That is, the building wasn't big enough. And so they have bought a $10 million building, and they're occupying it. Now, they rented it, they're part of it out, of course, that's... But anyway, it's quite an operation now. And I don't know, they got 50,000 members, something like that.
Wow.
It's on that order. And it's been a very successful operation. And they got all kinds of journals and books and publishing that they do, and run meetings, the same ones they used to run, plus some others. It's quite a show.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I don't claim any credit for this, except that I did get them off the dime. I got them out of the freebie university setting, out to where they can
university offices
do their
to
job.
A place where right. they can actually right. start maneuvering a little bit.
So I did that.
Yeah.
And in that sense, that I—that's my main contribution.
Oh, that's a significant contribution.
But I was later president myself. After I was secretary. Some years later, my time came, and mm-hmm. I was president. And this was at a time when some of the activists were at their height. This is mm-hmm. the anti-war activists.
Oh, different type of activists.
We had some trying to... Well, I think this was at the meeting in Boston, if my wife says. Maybe it was. I've forgotten just where I was president. But they tried to invade the general meeting and take over part of it. Well, they were not successful. But
they viewed you as...
Well, I don't know if they did me so much.
The society is...
Yeah, they were trying to... These were activists in the microbiology area. These were not foreigners came in. These were just activists, like we had them around the campus here.
Right.
Well, here's just some more of the same. Well, anyway, those were the days, and I'm glad they're over.
Now, you were a charter member of the American Academy of Microbiology.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I don't know exactly. Well, let's put it this way. I guess some of the more far-sighted bacteriologists, and I was not one of them. I was just another dairy bacteria, food bacteriologist, I guess. But others saw that the world was not limited. The microbial world was not limited to bacteria. Mm-hmm. We had protozoa, and we had a lot of other little animalcules swimming around in the water and in the soil, and causing disease and all kinds of things. And so that we should enlarge the scope of this society from Society of American Bacteriologists to the American Society for Microbiology, mm-hmm. so that it would incorporate the interests of a lot.
Get more people and also get a larger association.
Absolutely. And it went from about 5,000 to 50,000. Mm. It's over 50,000.
Oh, my.
Oh, yeah. And they were right. Now, this is partly because they incorporated some other areas, but it's mostly because microbiology grew. I mean, there's just a lot more microbiology now, and therefore a lot more people practicing it. Mm. And so we've got the whole field of virology, and we've got the parasitologists, and we've got the microbiologists, and we've got the bacteriologists, and they're all, theoretically at least, incorporated in this big structure of American Society for Microbiology. And then, of course, they're publishing journals that you wouldn't believe. They got a journal of virology, and they got a journal of general bacteriology, and they got a journal of medical microbiology. I don't remember the names of them, but anyway, It's something that has just developed naturally, but with a little push here and there.
So the American Academy of Microbiology was something that was just sort of...
I forgot that. They are the elitists. These are the boys who... they formed the academy to recognize people of outstanding merit who... in scientific merit, now, not financial.
Okay.
It recognizes people who've accomplished something, mm-hmm. you might say. And it gives a goal for some of the younger people to aspire to.
Okay.
And we've got all kinds of academies in medicine, you know. Well,
right.
It's just another one of those. I'm a member of the National of the American Academy of Microbiology, and I was president of that too at one time. So.
Now, there's also the Institute for Food Technologists.
Yeah.
Again, I believe you were a charter member on this one?
No, I was not a charter member, but okay. I came in fairly early.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the Institute for Food Technologists.
Okay. It was a little ahead of my time in terms of age. I don't remember the main forces that formed the Institute of Food Technologists, but Emil Marak of the University of California was big. And it, Gail Dack was big in it from the early days, and a lot of other people. And these were people who were interested in the technology of foods.
Mm-hmm.
They were interested in canning and in freezing and all the other aspects that go into the food supply. And so safety was just one sort of almost a minor part of it. But food technology is food manufacture. What it boils down to, the technology of making food or preparing food. And it's not just cooking, it's preserving it too. Freezing and drying and canning and all that sort of thing is technology. And these are the things you have to do to preserve the food supply to make it available in wintertime or whenever it's not available. And so that's the basis of food technology, is to preserve food, the techniques that go into preserving. And of course, spoilage and poisoning and everything is an aspect of that. And so it was natural that a microbiologist who's emphasizing foods would be involved.
Mm-hmm.
Microbiology is very much a part of the preservation. It's to prevent spoilage, it's preservation.
And it's no coincidence then that the Institute for Food Technologists that several winners of the Nicholas Appert Award were in that. You and Marks, that person from Davis, and Gail Dack, and
Gail Dack, and Marak, M-R-A-K.
Marak, that's it.
and me, and well, I could find your
There's
list.
There's probably
somewhere.
A list that would, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. What about the Wisconsin section? Oops, where's that here? Oh, another organization you belong to is the International Association of Milk and Food Sanitarians.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that. It sounds like an interesting group.
Oh, I don't know. They're a group of dairy microbiologists, if you will, who I guess aspired to bigger things.
Mm.
milk production or dairy products are very, very much involved with bacterial control.
Mm-hmm.
The milk will sour if you don't.
Makes sense.
If you don't prevent it, it'll sour or it'll get. Develop undesirable flavors, or it may even develop unhealthy situation. You may get pathogens in it. So milk is a kind of a delicate food in that
mm-hmm.
sense. And so as a result of that, the bacteriologists, I guess you'd say the food microbiologists, developed a special interest in milk and milk products. And of course, cheese is made by bacterial
right. action
and things of that mm-hmm. sort. So. Cheese, this is just a specialized area of food technology is what it amounts to. And when I was a graduate student here, I took a course in dairy bacteriology. See, we had two courses here when I came.
Mm-hmm.
One was dairy bacteriology taught by Professor Hastings. The other was food bacteriology taught by Professor Frazier. And when I joined the faculty, Frazier was still here. I replaced Hastings.
Mm-hmm.
I was his successor.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I joined the faculty, I assumed, I guess, that I would teach dairy bacteriology like Hastings did. But Frazier suggested, why don't we alternate them? Because he was trained with Hastings, too. And so he would teach food bacteriology 1 year, I'd teach the next. And same way with dairy.
Yeah.
We would alternate
Makes
them.
Sense,
and,
yeah.
So it was really, it could have all been one course, but it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin big, the dairy state.
Yes, that's right.
We had a course in dairy bacteriology. And there wasn't anything wrong with it.
Yeah.
It served a purpose. And it took care of those youngsters who wanted to go into the dairy industry, but they didn't necessarily want to need all that other stuff, the canning and all the other
mm-hmm.
stuff. So we had the two courses. I wrote a book on it. That is, I shared in the writing of a book on dairy microbiology. I never got into food microbiology writing because Frazier handled that.
Yeah.
He had a series of.
So that certainly explains your membership with the Association of Milk and Food Sanitarians.
Oh yeah,
so
oh sure.
The whole dairy
So that, their group, I mean that group, I would say was comparable really to the food technologists
mm-hmm.
in the sense that the milk and food technologists, or milk and food sanitarians I guess, they were mostly interested just in dairy products.
Mm-hmm.
And it went all the way from the farm, the extension man that goes out and checks the sanitation in the barn and all
yeah.
that stuff. It goes all the way from there into manufacturing of products, dairy products. So, I don't know, they're comparable,
mm-hmm.
I guess you would say. But being in Wisconsin, you certainly got to be in both of them.
Yeah, you better believe it. We're in the dairy state for nothing.
So,
the last organization that I wanted to discuss was the Toxicology Forum.
Yeah.
Was that anything of any significance?
Not really. There was I've forgotten even the origin of it, but I got involved in it early because I got almost everything early. And the Toxicology Forum was formed by a group of toxicologists who felt that we needed to have more knowledge about the toxicity of things
mm-hmm.
and I don't remember who was the guiding light in it, but I was part of it and was on the council at one time, but I didn't really have much to do with it.
Okay.
So I can't say much about it. The other two I remember very well.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, you were also, I have a section called Professional Assignments. You were involved in numerous professional assignments for several national councils, organizations, and commissions. I'd like to just discuss a couple of those more important ones today, or more prominent ones, at least to me. The first is the National Academy of Sciences National Research Council. Can you remember what
your
yeah. involvement?
Oh, yeah. I remember that one very well. The National Academy of Sciences, of course, is made up of very distinguished body of scientists. These, I don't know exactly how they support themselves, but they do. It's E.B. Fred is one of the leading ones that I knew, who was a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and there were lots of others, but it's a very exclusive, very distinguished body of scientists. And not everybody can be members. I was never a member of the National Academy. This is a reward that comes from distinguished science and service, and I don't know just how you... I think there's some political
probably,
help.
Yeah.
But whatever it is, it's a very exclusive, limited body. But they also formed the National Academy of Sciences, formed the National Research Council. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is the working body. They bring in all the people that they need to help them on committees. And I served on one committee after another of the National Research Council. And it is primarily there to advise the government. That's what its purpose is, as I understand it, is to advise the government. When a governmental agency needs some help on a scientific matter, they can come to the National Research Council. They will appoint a committee of experts to bring in, the government of course will give them a grant to pay the travel expenses, and the National Research Council then will bring in whomever they think is qualified. Mm-hmm. And I served on one after another of those things.
And then you present a report,
yeah,
a written
yeah.
report?
And we write a report, yeah. And it goes to the government agency that sponsors the study. Mm-hmm. So the government provides the question and the money. The National Research Council brings in the experts. They've got rooms there in Washington where they meet. They pay your expenses. They don't pay any per diems, I don't think, but anyway, they get the best advice they can, that's available on the question, whatever it may be. And I served on half a dozen of those. I can't remember the details of them, but I was chairman of a couple of them.
So it's sort of like a little think tank. They just bring in all these people from all these different areas. And great for you, you get to meet people that you might not have gotten to know otherwise.
With a little research, I could give you more details, but that's the way it worked.
That's interesting.
And the fact that, we knew the situation with the Academy, and members of the Academy were the, you might say, the sponsors, but they didn't really have much to do with what was going on in the National Research Council. And we were there to advise the government.
What about your work with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration?
Well, pretty much the same.
Pretty much the same.
Same thing. They had me as a consultant or an advisor or something. I've forgotten what they called me, but I was. They had several.
Okay.
And I advised them whenever they asked me.
So this were just different agencies bringing in different groups. Yeah. Does that hold true for the U.S. Department
of Agriculture
and the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission?
Well, I don't remember the Atomic Energy Commission because I only had one assignment.
Yeah, that seems a little bit out of your.
Yeah, it was. And they had me on a committee. Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah. It was an advisory committee, and I was a member of it. But I don't remember anything that we did. But they had problems with radiation of food. That was quite an amount of it.
Of course, yeah. And the other one that struck me is the U.S. Air Force School of Aviation Medicine.
Yeah, I've forgotten now just what that was all about. It was down in San Antonio. But they had me as an advisor on some kind of a committee or other. They, again, some of these federal government agencies had their own committees. They didn't go necessarily to the National Research Council. But the ones in Washington, it was easier, I think, to do it through the Research Council. Mm-hmm. Anyway. That's about all
that's
I remember.
That's great. Well, that's wonderful. I see how the structure's set up.
Yeah, I had a pretty good reputation, and a good old Mike was always available, you know.
Well, you had a lot of your work some of your work for the Food Research Institute was in Washington also, wasn't it, in terms of funding and things like that?
Don't remember much of, I had many trips to Washington, but they were mostly
these
sort of things we're talking about here.
Okay.
But I didn't do much in the way of raising money.
Okay.
That wasn't my job. And,
okay. That was Ed's...
he didn't do much either. Well, he did with industry, yes. But in terms of government money, the individual investigators would put in a proposal. And Well, we didn't have any such projects that involved the Institute itself. But if Bergdahl had a project on staph food poisoning, well, he put in a proposal to the Food and Drug Administration, and if he got a grant, he could hire the help and stuff. And I had really nothing to do with that except in a sort of administrative way.
You started with the Food Institute in 1966, and you were director of it until 1988. When you retired?
I started retiring. you ooze loud. Yeah. I turned it over to Parisa in 86. Yeah. That seemed like a good time. And so we had a meeting here of our industrial supporters, and I thought, well, you know, that would be a good time to hand the reins over to the next guy. And so we arranged it, and we had a meeting, and it was in the spring, our annual meeting. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, then wouldn't this be a good time to step out of the directorship? And so I went on part-time, and you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I hung around till, I retired in 87. Mm-hmm. Then they kept me on part-time until 89, I think. And I finally said, to hell with this stuff. I'm not doing anything useful. I wasn't really interested in it anymore. It was in good shape.
Right.
Why should I hang around there and just? I still got an office up there, but I don't use it.
Did you come back in any other context over the last decade?
No.
So you pretty much just let them.
I stepped out as director in 86, I think.
Yeah.
I retired in 87. I quit in 89. I went off the payroll completely. It was a reduced level until then.
As far as you can tell from your talks with Mike Parisa and Ed Traisman, is the Food Research Institute still just kind of doing the same kind of thing it's always done? Has it changed?
Of course, I know. I'm not aware of any real change. No, of course, we've had a lot of moves. We lost some real good people. They went to other jobs. Mm. Mike Doyle went to Georgia, and Charlie Duncan went to Hershey Foods, and Steve Taylor is head of food science at Nebraska. These are all top-notch stars, as far as I was concerned, when I was still active. Well, when Parisa was chosen to succeed me, I guess they maybe figured they'd take out their opportunities. And they got them, and they've done very well. Duncan was my own graduate student. He's now vice president of Hershey Foods, has been for years. Mm. And as I say, Doyle went to Georgia, where he was chairman of the food science for a while. He's gave that up because he didn't like commuting over to Athens. He lives near the experiment station. See, the experiment station and the university are 70 miles apart, or 80, something. So he lived near the experiment station. That's where his institute or his group is. So he's now just directing their research program in food safety. Taylor was a food technologist that we had. He went to Nebraska, and he's now head of food science there. Mm-hmm. So they've all done well, but they couldn't all be the next director here.
The next director.
I think any one of them would have been a good one.
Yeah.
But Parisa's here, the right man in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. Well, it's better to have a more good, all those good people, you know.
Sure. So there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
And they've got some good people now.
Yeah. When I talk to people beforehand about the person I'm going to interview, I always ask them if they have a question they'd like me to ask you, sort of on their behalf. And I asked Ed Traisman about that, and he asked that I ask you to comment on the current status of the safety of food. And he talked about, for example, the hoopla in Europe right now concerning biotechnology in foods.
Yeah, I've thought about that a great deal. And I think it's all a bunch of hogwash. I don't think there's any basis for it, whatever. But somebody has sold these people on the idea that genetic change is bad and it might hurt you.
Are these the same kind of sort of myths that were coming out?
I think so.
About food coloring and
as far as I'm concerned, it is. I don't have any basis to think there's any
fact to it at all. I think it's an appeal to people's, let's say, ignorance, I guess you would call it. I don't know, a lack of knowledge anyway. I don't know, and I don't know exactly in whose interest this is serving.
Yeah, it's very odd.
That's the hard thing for me to say. But I could say the same thing back here to about the hamburger and all that other things. I don't understand. I got to understand how Barry Commoner got misled. He did an experiment with bacterial mutation, but he didn't have to extrapolate it all the way to where he did. Now, what's happening today with regard to the genetic alteration of plants, I just don't understand that myself. I don't know why. But somehow they've been able to appeal to the ignorance of the people over there and make them think that this is bad.
They'll just create horror stories on
things I guess
that
so.
Can have the mutations.
And I don't know whose interest this is serving either. But it's obviously serving somebody's, and they're getting away with it.
Well, you know, really, if you think about it, it's sort of like a biotechnology version of this. Again, the same kind of things the same kind of scares, maybe even promulgated by the same kind of people who were the activists back when you were fighting the battles back in the. That would be an interesting thing to look at.
It would.
See, the sons and daughters of those same people aren't the ones who are.
Well, I just don't know what is motivating them, and I don't know what the basis is on which they're able to sell it, but boy, they sure are.
Yeah.
And it's spreading. It seems to me that there's some hints of it over here, too, that at least objections to it.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the basis for those is.
Interesting. That'll be a story to continue.
That'll be a story
watch.
For the future.
Yeah.
You can go
and something that probably, wouldn't that be something that the Food Research Institute might get involved in at some point?
Might. They might.
I mean, so it would seem like a natural.
They and the geneticists.
Yeah, and the geneticists.
Yeah, the geneticists ought to be the ones that ought to be shook up here. This it
yes.
seems to me.
Yes.
Because here they are trying to breed better strains, and better types, and better this and better that, stronger, healthier, whatever. But now, if they're going to get all that shot down by. Well, it might be harmful.
Yeah.
That's all they're hearing, I think. That's sort of anti-intellectual.
Anti-intellectual
is the word exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would think that the geneticists would be as concerned here as anybody. But anyway, it's beyond me.
Well, you also wonder when and why that the shift, what happened. Because, I mean, back when I was growing up, you see Blaine seed corns on the side, and people are making these genetics changes in the genetics of corn, and they grow bigger, and they grow
faster,
and drier weather.
Yep.
And we all thought, wow, this is great. Yep. We can feed people more and more. At what point and for what reasons, it would be interesting to try to determine, did this shift occur?
You better get a psychologist.
Yeah. There we go. Geneticist and a psychologist.
It's out of my... But I'm just as intrigued as you are by why it's happening and how it's happening. And I'm a little bit disturbed, but I can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Can't answer it.
Yeah.
Thank goodness it's not my problem.
It's not your problem.
But I will say this. As far as the food safety is concerned, I think I don't think there's any question about it. Our food is just as safe as it ever was, if not more so. Mm-hmm. And I think more so, personally. And I'm talking microbiologically now. We have learned to cope with these things. The industry has. And the people. We don't have the kinds of food poisoning outbreak. We still have some of the ones. But it's not because of any fault of the manufacturers or anybody else. It's ignorance, mostly, that things go wrong because we don't do them right. We know how to do them. And the food industry, the food scientists, the food microbiologists, we know how to control these things. But sometimes people who don't understand will misuse or mishandle foods, and we do have an occasional outbreak of illness. That is pretty rare compared to, seems to me, what it used to be. Heck, I remember as a kid, we were always, people were always talking about getting, ptomaine, they called it. Ptomaine poisoning. Well, that means they got a staph infection, staph poisoning or salmonella or something, in all probability. Mm-hmm. Well, we've gone a long way, I think, and I don't know what the Food Research Institute's had anything to do with it. Not that we've contributed some to improving the understanding. Certainly, the food industry itself, which has grown up tremendously since I was a kid, they know what they're doing. They better.
Yeah.
You get a product out there on the market, and you poison 10,000 people. Boy, you're in deep trouble.
In this litigious society, yes, sir, it's called being out of business.
You bet. Exactly what it is. And so, industry, they hire good people. They hire our graduates. They hire others, and they're not dummies. So the crafts and the others, the people who are in the business, Oscar Myers, and of course that's all one now. They know what they're doing. I remember the first real research project I had here was Oscar Mayer wanted to know what would happen if liver sausage was abused. Would botulinum grow in it? They had enough sense to ask those questions. Mm-hmm. That's where I got my first grant.
Mm-hmm.
Find out.
Yeah.
And that's the way Paul Sankey got a PhD. Well,
that's interesting.
On and on it goes.
Mike Parisa asked me to ask you, if you had it to do over again, would you do it over again if you had the chance?
Oh, absolutely. No problem. Absolutely. I would welcome the opportunity. I'd try to do it better. Mm-hmm. I would try to use my time more effectively. I wouldn't say efficiently, but I was meeting myself coming and going to Washington and every place else and making speeches, and I was working my tail off. Well, I didn't mind that. I think I would... After the fact, I think I can see where I might have done it more effectively and maybe not wasted so much time and energy messing around. I wasn't deliberately just dawdling. I think I was doing a lot of jobs because people asked me to.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have been more selective. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. And probably left me then more time and energy to do the things that needed to be done.
We'd have only given 18 speeches a month
instead of 26. Well, yeah, I guess that's a pretty good way to express it. But other than that, I'm not complaining about what I did do. I would do it over again. You bet. I might do it a little differently, that's all.
I end every interview by giving the person I've interviewed the last word. Do you have any closing comments you would like to make about your career at the University of Wisconsin?
Yeah. When I face a question like that, I immediately think of those days when I was 11, 12 years old on the farm. And I'd look up at that hot sun picking cotton and say, you know, there's got to be a better way to make a living. I was getting a penny a pound for picking it. I picked maybe 50 pounds a day. But I got out of that largely because my mother insisted. And she was always pushing. And I was lucky. And I had some help from relatives and others. And I managed to escape. And Wisconsin was the solution to my problems. And I'll never forget how grateful I've been for the opportunity to serve the University of Wisconsin. I can't imagine any school I'd rather be at. I can't imagine any job I'd rather have than to be a professor at the University of Wisconsin.
I think that what else can be said? We'll end the interview on that note. Thank you very much, Professor Foster.